himself a title from a Bourbon king along with his bride, he possessed enough cachet for our mother to proudly claim him as an ancestor. In the beginning, our legacy came from smuggling and the corsair's more nefarious activities. Soon his children and grandchildren began diversifying the family's fortune, and through an advantageous marriage in the late 19th century, the Perezes became sugar barons. For better, worse, and the truly horrific, sugar has molded Cuba's fortunes. The corsair stares us down as we tiptoe through the hall, and while the rest of our ancestors seem to disapprove of this act of rebellion from atop their oil and canvas perches, I fancy that our pirate ancestor, with his dark hair and even darker eyes twinkling with mischief, would have wholeheartedly approved. We slip our shoes off at the top of the staircase in an act of choreographed sisterly precision. The marble is cool against my toes, despite the warm air tonight, the moon casting a sliver of light across the steps. We freeze as noises coming from the general direction of the kitchen filter throughout the house. Is the risk we're taking really worth the reward of a night of freedom? The punishment? Temporary removal to the country. Forced attendance at teas and luncheons, parties where we're jettisoned from one eligible son of one of our father's business associates to another. Life as usual. They're fighting in Cuba's eastern provinces. In the Oriente, boys not much older than me, boys who should be at university, who would be at university if Batista hadn't closed the University of Havana out of fear years ago. The revolutionaries are fighting throughout the country, storming the presidential palace, seeking to overthrow the government, to end Batista's corruption. And yet, behind the high walls of our Miramar home, the ancient regime reigns supreme. My mother has no time for revolutions. They wreak havoc with her balls and teas. It is a strange time to be Cuban, to feel the stirrings beneath your feet, hear the rumblings in the sky, and to continue on as though nothing is happening at all. Stranger still to be a woman in Cuba. We vote. But what does a vote mean when election outcomes are a foregone conclusion? The women in our family attended the best schools, grew up with a slew of tutors, each one more harried and harassed by all of us, Beatrice in particular. But Perez women do not work, no matter how much we might wish to do so. We are useless birds in a gilded cage, while our country women serve in the government, while some plot revolution. Times have changed in our little island, a tinder lit, spreading like wildfire throughout Cuba. Meanwhile, our estates are a bulwark against modernization, change, freedom. And so, occasionally, we do exceedingly foolish things like sneaking out of the house in the dead of night, because it's impossible to stand near the flame consuming everything around you and not have some of that fire catch the hem of your skirt, too. We make it to the front door, pausing once for a maid completing her duties for the night, a song under her breath. Once the maid has finished dusting the entryway table, Isabel exits first, leaving me to close the heavy front door behind me with a wince. I slip my mother's sandals back onto my feet, freezing at the sight of Beatrice lounging against her convertible. Her dress looks as though it was painted onto her voluptuous body, and I don't know where she bought it or where she's been hiding it, but you wear a dress like that when you want to create a scandal. She flaunts it beautifully. Of all of Emilio Perez's daughters, Beatrice is the most apt to court scandal, to push at the edges of the cage, occasionally breaking free. She fights with our parents about attending university, wants to study law, quotes philosophers and radicals, and she insisted we sneak out tonight. "Are you ready?" Beatrice asks. Her gaze runs over me, and when she doesn't say anything, I relax slightly. Beatrice's sartorial elegance is undisputed in Havana. "I thought we talked about discretion," Isabel grouses behind me. "Parking your car in front of the house where anyone can see is not discreet." "No one will say anything," Beatrice scoffs, They're too terrified of our mother to broach the subject. Our father runs his businesses, but our mother rules our home with a jewel-covered fist. You're too careless, Isabel retorts. I tune them out, their bickering a common refrain in our household. My gaze drifts across the high stone walls to my best friend Anna's house. I count the windows as I've done for years until I reach the second floor, settling on the third one down. The light is on in her bedroom. Elisa! Isabel gets into the car's back seat, waving me on, while Beatriz somehow slides into the driver's seat, despite her constricting dress. I follow my sisters out into the night. The party is at a house in Vedado, a few blocks away from the University of Havana. The host is a friend of a friend of a friend of Isabel's boyfriend, Alberto. Beatriz navigates a parking spot, and once she's parked, we exit the car, and I trail behind her and Isabel. Guests spill out of the entrance, the house brimming with noise and music, vibrating with laughter. It's a pretty enough structure, 2 stories tall and painted in a clean white color. A balcony juts off the second floor, more guests filling the space. At first glance, it's obvious we're overdressed. Significantly so. We might as well announce to the entire room that we aren't from here, that we belong to a different part of the city. Our aim tonight is anonymity. Our names and faces are relatively well known, but I doubt this crowd spends much time poring over the society pages of Diario de la Marina. Beatriz charges through the crowd, her hips swaying, a woman on a mission. She was so intent on coming here tonight that I can't help but wonder if Isabel isn't the only one dating a man our parents don't wholly approve of. At the same time, if Beatriz were dating someone inappropriate, she would be the last to hide it. No, she'd proudly parade him in front of all. Seating him at the grand dining room table our mother had shipped from Paris to compete with her rival and best friend whose own dining room table sailed from England. Benny Moré is on the record player, couples dancing anywhere and everywhere, their bodies a little closer than you typically see at my mother's formal parties. Hands drifting a little lower, fingers clutching fabric, their cheeks pressed against each other. The women dance with a freedom I covet, their hips sinuous, their movements leaving no doubt that they embrace every ounce of femininity God gave them. There's passion of varying degrees and inspirations throbbing in the air, occupying the cracks and crevices of the party, tucked away behind clasped hands, soaring above bent heads, a sort of frenzy that seeps into your bones. The crowd swallows Isabel and Beatriz up until I'm left alone, standing on the fringes of the party in my too formal dress, searching for a familiar face, someone else who's somewhere they shouldn't be, torn between discomfort at the raw emotions lingering under the surface and a faint prick of envy. I accept one of the drinks they're generously passing around, the rum sweeter than any I'm used to. Stronger, too. Finding a comfortable place against the wall where I can observe everyone. In a family like mine, you grow accustomed to watching from the shadows. I've never been like Beatriz, happiest taking risks. Nor am I Isabel, truculently in love, or Maria, prone to outbursts. This, watching couples dance, listening to music, taking the occasional sip of rum, is more than enough for me. At least, it was. And then I see him. Strangely, I notice the suit before I notice the man. Cuban society is not quiet society. We flaunt our wealth and status like peacocks. He is no peacock. His suit isn't impeccably tailored to fit his frame, and it isn't designed to impress. It's functional. A no-nonsense black that drapes a tall, lean body. I like him better for the simplicity. I'm more than a little tired of peacocks. He's speaking with 2 other men, his hands shoved in his pockets, his gaze cast downward. He has a strong jaw, sharp cheekbones, and a surprisingly full, lush mouth on a hard face. His skin is a shade or two darker than mine, his dark hair an unruly mess curling at the ends. He doesn't smile. I sip the rum, watching him, attempting to guess his age. Most of the party appears to be a little older than me, in their early 20s, perhaps, and while there's a severity about him, he doesn't look that much older. His lips move rapidly when he talks, his hands in constant motion. My foot taps in time with the music, mimicking the beat of my heart as I watch him, willing him to look at me, to notice me. And miraculously, he does. Maybe the dress is a little magic. He turns, mid-conversation, his hands lingering in the air like a conductor instructing a symphony, surveying the crowd, the same hardness in his eyes that's stamped all over his face. There's a hunger there, though, beneath that hardness, a hunger I've seen before. The kind that looks at the world and isn't afraid to say it isn't good enough, that there must be more, to demand change. He looks like a man who believes in things, which is truly terrifying these days. My breath hitches. His eyes widen slightly, as though he can hear my breath over the sound of Benny Moré, the laughter and sin spilling all over the party. He doesn't appear callous, merely as though life has tested him and roughed his edges. His gaze rests on me, and those lips pause for a moment. He doesn't do the polite thing and glance away, or pretend he was looking at something else and just happened to catch me in his path. No. He settles in and looks me over. And slowly, so slowly, a smile spreads across his face. And suddenly, surprisingly, he's handsome. I freeze, my mother's voice in my ear. Don't fidget. Smile. Not too much. Put your shoulders back. Until her voice disappears, floating above this party she would never approve of. And in the space of a heartbeat, he's standing in front of me. A little taller, a little more broad-shouldered than he appeared to be across the room. I swallow, tilting my head up, staring into solemn brown eyes.
Hello,
he says, offering a perfectly ordinary greeting in a voice that is anything but. Hello, I echo, traversing 1,000 guesses surrounding who he is, what he does, why he crossed the room to speak to me, in the time between those hellos. His lips curve, those eyes softening a bit.
I'm Pablo.
I turn his name over and over in my head, testing out the sound of it to my ears alone, before giving him my own. Elisa. An elbow brushes past me, jostling me. I lurch forward, the rum in my glass tipping precariously, entirely too close to Pablo's black suit. He reaches out, steadying me, his hand connecting with my arm. I blink again, in an attempt to right myself. My drink isn't the only thing that's tilted on its axis.
I've never seen you at one of Guillermo's parties before, he says.
Guillermo must be our host, the friend of a friend of a friend or something or other, of Isabel's boyfriend. I've never been to one before. He nods, that same solemn expression on his face, and I revise my guess about his age. He is older. Late 20s or early 30s, perhaps. Another person nudges my back, and Pablo shifts, putting his body between me and the rest of the crowd, his hand exerting the faintest pressure on my elbow to steady me. The song changes, the tempo increasing, guests dancing to the spirited beat as we remain pressed up against the wall. His hand on my elbow. His fingers are long and lean. They tell the story of a man who works with his hands, slightly incongruous with the dark, well-worn suit and the party's solidly Havana crowd. Pablo's hand falls to his side. I look up. His mouth is parted slightly, His gaze narrowed as though he doesn't know what to make of what he sees. Another body bumps into us. The rum lists in my glass. Pablo leans into me, his voice rising to be heard over the loud music, the laughter. My heartbeat thrums, equal parts nerves and anticipation running through my veins.
"Do you want to step outside?"
he asks.
"It's quieter out there."
It seems the most natural thing in the world to give him my hand and follow him out of the party. Chapter 4. Pablo leads me through the house, his steps guided by purpose and familiarity. We weave through the crowd, and I search for Beatriz and Isabel as we walk. But I can't find them in the throng. Every so often, Pablo turns around and glances at me, his fingers laced with mine. We step out into the night, the backyard nearly empty as we walk toward a palm tree to the side of the house. The backyard abuts another, the lots small and crammed together. He's right. It is quieter outside, the roar of music and partygoers now a low hum. I look up at the sky, the stars shining down on us, taking the opportunity to compose myself. When I glance back at him, he's not looking at me, but up at the stars as well, his gaze hooded. I jump at the sound of a boom off in the distance, then another, and another. The explosion is far away, relegated to another part of the city, but these days it could signal anything. Gunfire, fireworks, bombs. I glance at Pablo, his attention no longer on the sky, but focused on me. His expression is unreadable, as though he has grown immune to the sounds of violence and armed revolt. "Those probably aren't fireworks," I comment, my heart pounding.
"Probably not," he agrees.
I wait for him to say more, for him to remark on the recent violence, but he's surprisingly quiet. I'm used to men who fill conversations, offering me little opportunity to speak. "How long have you known Guillermo?" I ask, searching for some place to start. It's more private out here, but it was easier back in the party, the music and people filling the spaces and silences in our conversation. Now it's up to us, and I'm at a loss for words. I know how to speak to people from my own world, people who have mastered the art of speaking without saying anything at all. But I can't imagine having such a conversation with the boy, man, standing before me. He seems like the sort who parses and weighs his words with economy and care. Pablo doesn't answer me right away, those brown eyes piercing, his gaze lingering on my feet, and I immediately regret my decision to wear my mother's fine Parisian shoes. His are black, the leather creased in places from wear.
"Years,"
he replies absent-mindedly, his gaze still on my ridiculous shoes.
"We've known each other for years."
I shuffle back and forth, my mother's voice in my ear again.
"Don't fidget, Elisa."
Surely this time a little fidgeting is warranted. "How do you know Guillermo?" I press on, motivated not only by his answer, but a desire to remove his attention from my footwear. His manner makes me a bit bolder. The inclination that he's also off balance, attention threading through his silence. This time he looks into my eyes, a ghost of a smile on his mouth.
"We went to law school together years ago."
The University of Havana has been closed for 2 years now, so he must have graduated a while ago.
"How do you know Guillermo?"
he counters.
"I don't. He's a friend of a friend of a friend of my sister's boyfriend, or something like that. I came with my sisters."
The words escape in a whoosh. I take a deep breath. Then another.
"Are you from the city?"
I ask, attempting to place him in the insular circle of Havana society.
"Just down the street, actually."
It isn't the nicest neighborhood, but far from the worst.
There's a twinkle in his eye when he asks his next question, and before the words leave his mouth, I know these stupid shoes have given me away.
Miramar?
I nod, slightly embarrassed by the knowing tone of voice, the images my neighborhood's name conjures up. Havana's wealthiest citizens live in our own private enclave, and the rest of the city knows it. I was raised from birth to be proud of being a Perez. We all were. My sisters and I cannot work, but that doesn't mean we don't do our part to carry our family's mantle. That it hasn't been instilled in us that we must never tarnish our family's reputation, our every word, every action reflecting on the Perez name, the legacy of our ancestors resting on our shoulders. Still, this is the point in the conversation when I wish I had more to contribute, that I could share career ambitions or something similar. It has not escaped my notice that so many of my countrywomen are far more accomplished than me. Thanks to our father's insistence, we had the finest education, are well acquainted with the classics. Thanks to our mother's influence, we have been trained in the art of entertaining, hosting dinners, organizing charity functions, living, breathing decorations that form part of the trappings of our family's empire. Times are changing in Cuba. How long will we be little more than ornaments? Pablo walks forward a bit before turning back to face me, his shoulders listing with the effort, and I'm surprised by how lean he is, the suit hanging from the slope of his shoulders.
What's life like in Miramar?
He asks. Probably what you'd imagine. I feel as though I've become a point of curiosity, an exhibit like the island of crocodiles at the Havana Zoo. Those mighty animals sunning their backs with contempt for the gawking tourists and locals who point and exclaim over their size. Being a Perez in Havana, one of the sugar queens, is akin to wondering if you should charge admission for the window into your life. The stories they print in Diario de la Marina and the like. Beatriz welcomes the attention. Isabel attempts to cast off the veneer of notoriety. And I'm somewhere in the middle. Maria is too young to care either way. Her chief amusements are still playing in the pool in the backyard.
Fobbing off marriage proposals and attending parties all day?
Pablo teases. I fight back an utterly unladylike snort. Yes to the parties. No to the marriage proposals.
Then the men in Miramar are fools.
His tone is light, bantering, but the solemnity in his gaze makes my heart pound. Suddenly the nerves are too much, and I turn, looking out to the direction of the sea. I can't see it, but I can hear the sound of the waves crashing along the malecón. Pablo's voice comes from somewhere behind me in the dark night.
You missed a button. On your dress.
I swallow.
May I?
He asks. I nod, my mouth dry. My mother would be thoroughly appalled to see her daughter standing outside a party such as this one, a strange man buttoning her dress. My mother would be thoroughly appalled. And yet, I turn, lifting my hair, bringing it to the side, baring my nape to him. A tremor slides through my body. Pablo steps behind me, close enough that his fingers brush against the line of tiny buttons running down my spine. It feels like an eternity before his fingers slip the button through the slim hole, setting it to rights. It could be my imagination, but I swear his fingers twitch against me. Or perhaps it's my own body that shudders. There's a novelty to this that catches me off guard. He is both old and new at once. And I can't ignore the voice inside me that's pushed out my mother's now. Pay attention. This is important. He is important. Pablo releases a deep breath, stepping back. I turn to face him. There's surprise on his face, the kind that sneaks up on you and isn't entirely welcome.
You're very young, aren't you?
The words themselves are tinged with the faintest hint of disapproval, but I can't shake the feeling that the sentiment is directed more to himself than me. I swallow, tilting my head, refusing to be cowed. 19. 19 and a pampered bird in a gilded cage. He gives a soft little laugh, his hand running through his hair. It's a bit long around the edges, unkempt, as though it's been some time since he visited a barber. It's a stark contrast to his clean-shaven face, his tanned skin at odds with an attorney's days spent indoors behind a desk. My father knows a host of attorneys, men who bow and scrape before him. Does he know this one?
19 is very young.
He says the words more for himself than me, an aside in an internal conversation he seems to be having. I have older siblings. My interactions with men I'm interested in may be limited, but I'm well-versed in the art of standing up for myself when I need to. And you? I toss the question out like a challenge.
30.
The number isn't shocking, nor is the age difference. My mother stopped celebrating birthdays ages ago, but the chasm between my own parents is impossible to miss. Not that old, I say, even though I doubt he's merely speaking of physical age. I feel new and shiny next to him. In contrast, he's interesting. A sanded down veneer covered in telltale signs of experience.
Perhaps.
He's silent for a moment. That word, a door shutting on me. The conversation. Whatever this is. I should go, I say, taking a step forward, away from him. Pablo's head bows slightly.
I'm sorry.
I don't move.
I shouldn't.
His voice breaks off and he shakes his head.
I'm in a foul mood tonight. I didn't come here looking for a party, only to speak to Guillermo, and I certainly didn't come here expecting to meet you. That's no excuse for being rude.
He takes a deep breath.
A friend died recently. I came to talk to Guillermo about it.
He pauses again, as though he's searching for the right words.
I'm at a loss,
he finally says. I'm sorry about your friend. My feet, those shoes that seem filled with ideas and ambition, take a step toward him. Then another. I rest my hand on his arm, the hem of my dress brushing against his trousers. A hint of tobacco and spice filling my nostrils. The body beneath my palm is all tightly coiled strength. His eyes are wide. This, touching a man I barely know, is wholly inappropriate. Everything about this evening has firmly teetered away from respectability. And he's right. He was a bit rude earlier. I should go inside, find my sisters, and return home. This man isn't one of the tame boys my parents have trotted out in front of me as suitable escorts. He possesses an edge even I can't miss. There's that flame, licking at my skirts again. Was he a good friend?
He was a good man,
Pablo answers after a beat. He takes a step back, putting distance between us, doing the appropriate thing when logic and reason seem to have picked their skirts up in one hand and fled. It's funny how that little step can change everything, but it does. It's as though he cedes territory, and in his retreat, a burst of courage fills me. Whatever this is, he's equally unsettled, and some entirely feminine urge I didn't realize I possessed has me straightening my shoulders, tilting my head, meeting his gaze, my lashes fluttering closed. Happy to play the coquette, if only for the span of this evening. A rueful grin covers his mouth, a glint of admiration in his eyes. His hand drifts to his heart, a hint of mockery in his demeanor.
You must forgive me. I fear I'm at a loss for words. No one ever warned me about the dangers of debutantes.
And how many debutantes have you known? I ask. Measuring my tone against his, in an effort to keep things light between us. even though there's sincerity in the question. You learn fairly early on that there are men who will attempt to court you because of your last name, because your father is power, and they want to grasp it in their greedy hands, because they dream of wealth, and slipping a ring on your finger is the easiest way to obtain it. I don't sense that he's such a man, but the impulse to be wary is there just the same. None. A flutter kicks up in my stomach. I really should go inside. Am I dangerous? I test the word out and decide I like the taste and sound of it. His expression turns somber.
I have a feeling you just might be.
The flutter takes flight.
I should go inside,
he says, echoing my earlier words. He doesn't move. We both stare at each other, unblinking, the ocean roaring in the background, my heart thundering in my chest. Now I understand a bit better what drives Beatriz and Isabel, how they can throw caution to the wind for one night of freedom. I'm curious in a way I haven't been before. Curious and perhaps just a little bit reckless. Pablo looks pained as the question falls from his lips.
Will you meet me tomorrow? By the malecón?
Yes.
Chapter 5. Marisol. I sleep longer than intended. The sheets worn and soft, the mattress surprisingly comfortable. The afternoon sunlight has dimmed by the time I wake. I reach for my cell phone, the limited Cuban telecommunications connectivity, rendering it virtually useless but for the clock display. It's almost 8 o'clock in the evening. I napped for 3 hours. It's strange to be so separated from the rest of the world. From my sisters, my friends, my editor. But that's part of the Cuban experience, I suppose. Adding to the sensation that I truly have journeyed to the land of my grandmother's memories. Firmly walled off from my life back home in Miami. There are a limited number of places where you can get internet here, and even then it's unreliable at best. There is no service in private homes, and everyone told me to expect to be cut off for the week I was staying with the Rodriguez family. My cell service doesn't work either, so it's just Cuba and me. I climb out of bed, padding to the window and pulling back the curtain, staring at the view in front of me. The sky is gold. A palette edged in pinks and blues. The sun a radiant ball of fire as it drifts into the horizon. The ocean is equally stunning. Back home it would be a multi-million-dollar view. One many would clamor to possess. I've seen some beautiful sights in my life. But my grandmother was right. This really is paradise. My gaze drifts to the patio beneath my room. A few tables are empty, but the dinner crowd has begun gathering. Glasses clink. Silverware scrapes across dishes, and the aroma of black beans and rice fills the air. I grew up eating Cuban food. Between my grandmother's love of cooking and the plethora of Cuban restaurants on Calle Ocho and beyond, black beans and rice have always been a staple in my diet. I pause as Luis comes into view. He walks toward one of the tables, plates in hand, setting them down in front of a family of tourists before exchanging a few words with them in the same flawless English he used when he greeted me at the airport. He bobs and weaves through the tables crammed into the tiny outdoor space, moving past one of the waitresses in a coordinated dance. There's an economy and efficiency to their movements as they pass by each other without speaking. Luis says something else to one of the diners, offering a friendly smile, and then he looks up at my window and our gazes connect. I don't get a smile, just a faint inclination of his head before he disappears from view. Trading places with the same waitress from earlier, a pretty brunette. In his absence, my attention turns back to the view ahead of me, the ocean and beyond. The sound of the saxophone returns, low, haunting, each note aching and melancholy. The music fills me with a soaring emotion, and it doesn't surprise me in the least when the saxophone player steps into the little courtyard, his eyes finding mine as his lips press against the instrument. His fingers flying over the keys, playing for the guests. That explains the calluses. History professor, musician, waiter. The legacy of the Cuban Revolution, donning many hats to stay afloat. Luis doesn't look away from me as he plays, his stare unblinking, sending another tremor through me, his fingers caressing the keys with practiced ease. The first strands of Guantanamera drift over the courtyard, goosebumps rising over my skin as the tourists gasp and clap somewhere in the background. It's a beautiful song, one every Cuban knows. The ballad taken from one of our greatest national treasures, José Martí's poem, Versos Sencillos, and performed by a queen, Celia Cruz. He plays it beautifully. I force myself to step away, slipping back into the room, running water over my face from a sink in the corner, fixing my makeup. My hair's prone to frizzing in humidity, and it's risen to the occasion provided by the Cuban climate, the black strands cascading down my back in a wild mix of curls. I grab a scarf from my bag, using it to tie my hair back. Minutes later, I shut the door behind me, venturing out into the hallway. The sounds of the kitchen reverberate throughout the house, the footfalls of the residents in the apartment upstairs thudding through the worn ceiling. I follow the smell of food, making my way down the chipped marble staircase to the lower level of the house where the paladar is located. The kitchen is tucked in the back, a surprisingly small space for the amount of activity taking place inside it. The appliances are old and clearly well used, knobs broken off, piecemeal parts strung together. The walls are covered in hanging pots and utensils, the economy of space solved by ingenuity. There are no fancy copper pots and pans here. No double ovens or commercial stoves, no massive center islands. Nothing like my grandmother's kitchen in the house on Alhambra Circle and Coral Gables. The food, though, obviously doesn't know the difference. Black beans, rice, maduros, sweet fried plantains, and roast pork await the tourists seated outside, and judging by the mouth-watering smell emanating from the kitchen, they're in for a treat. Three women bustle around the kitchen. Ana Rodriguez, another woman who looks a lot like Luis, and a third, the waitress from earlier. The waitress has dark hair contained in a tight bun, strands escaping at intervals, a clipped expression on her face as she moves at a frenetic pace. I duck my head as her gaze runs over my appearance, taking in the sandals that cost more than most Cubans make in a year. When I packed for this trip, I intentionally chose the least flashy pieces in my closet, opting for comfort and simplicity over high fashion. Not that it matters. We both know the difference. And shame fills me at the condemnation in her eyes. She brushes past me, a plate of tostones in hand for the tourists, the scent of the salty fried plantains filling the tiny space. The older woman, she has to be Luisa's mother, eyes me as though I'm an alien dropped in her midst before grabbing more food and exiting the cramped kitchen. Ana turns, a smile on her face, spoon in hand. "Did you sleep well?" she asks me. "I did, thank you." "Good. Are you hungry?" "A bit, but I can wait. Can I help you with anything?" I know a thing about Cuban pride, and yet I feel like an interloper here, an unnecessary burden to a family who has likely faced more than their share. Ana waves me off and points to a tiny table shoved in the corner. "Sit, sit. You'll eat and we'll chat while I finish up the meal. We have one table left, and then we'll be done for the night." "How many guests do you serve each meal?" "It varies by day. About 100 between lunch and dinner." The expression on my face must say it all. She laughs. "You get used to it after a while." "How long have you had the restaurant?" A twinkle enters her eyes. "Officially? 20 years or so. Unofficially, perhaps a bit longer than that. Luis cooked here when he was in university and still does occasionally." She scoops a heaping portion of beans and rice and spoons them into a white bowl with a floral pattern along the rim, setting it on the table in front of me where a napkin and silverware lay. A glass of guarapo follows, the sweet drink coating my throat in sugar. Ana gestures towards the plate. "Eat. Then you can have some pork and some plantains." "Thank you." The beans have thickened, the taste familiar comfort food. There are subtle differences between Ana's beans and those I've grown up eating in Miami, but their essence is inescapably similar. "This is amazing," she beams. "Thank you." Ana returns to the dinner service for a few minutes while I eat before turning to face me. I received pieces of the story from my letter to Beatrice, but I gather there's more to your visit than merely wanting to see Cuba or writing an article. There is. My grandmother left a letter spelling out her last wishes to me. Her attorney gave it to me when her will was read. Her desire was to be cremated and to have her ashes spread in Cuba. Anna doesn't seem surprised by this news, which leads me to think this isn't the first time she's heard of my grandmother's request. When Isabel died, she asked to be buried in the United States beside her American husband, who died a year before. I'd assumed my grandmother would want the same thing, to be buried beside my grandfather at the cemetery in Miami. We'd never discussed it, though. I'd always thought we'd have more time together. The stroke came on unexpectedly and swiftly, stealing her from us in the night. If we were to be comforted by anything, it was the knowledge that her doctor said it likely had been a painless way to pass. "And she chose you to do it," Anna says. "You were always her favorite. Did she ever tell you why? I'm curious for this side of my grandmother I otherwise wouldn't have known." Anna smiles. "She did." I wait while she peels and chops a plantain with shaky fingers. "Lucia is your father's daughter, confident, determined, driven. She pushes herself constantly. For her, the accomplishment is in the attempt. It isn't an unfair assessment of my sister. I love Lucia, but she's always blazed her own path, determined to make her way despite our family's last name. Her world is her horses, her friends, distinct from the one the rest of us inhabit. She shows up for major family events, is never more than a phone call away, but we've never been that close despite the mere 2 years between us. Daniela is... trouble," I finish with a smile. No condemnation in the word. Daniela is my favorite sister, the eldest, the adventurous one. She's the closest to our mother, perhaps by virtue of her age, and as far as I know, has never backed down from a challenge. Anna laughs. "I might have heard something to that effect. And then there's me. Your grandmother saw herself in you, always. You're the romantic, the dreamer. The one who's searching for something. She always prayed you would find it. You were the most affected by your parents' divorce." Her mouth tightens in a firm line. "By your mother leaving. You needed Elisa, and she you. And now she's gone. I've become unmoored with my grandmother's passing. Anna is right. My grandmother was my anchor, and now that she's gone, I'm adrift. She was so proud of you, Marisol. Always." She slides a plate of maduros and lechon asado in front of me. "Will you eat too?" I ask. "Perhaps a bit." I wait while she serves a smaller plate for herself, taking the seat opposite mine. Behind her, the two women re-enter the kitchen, dumping plates into the sink with loud clunks before exiting again. Anna begins eating and I follow suit. The pork is the perfect mix of succulent meat and fat. The plantains a sweet, sharp bite washed down with the saccharine drink. "Where will you spread her ashes?" Anna asks. "I don't know. I hoped you could help me with that. I asked Aunt Beatrice and Aunt Maria, and they offered a few ideas. I asked my father as well. But he'd had little to propose beyond the Perez home. He loved my grandmother, but he was much closer to my grandfather in childhood and adulthood." "What did they say?" she asks. "They suggested the house where she grew up. The very house that is now inhabited by a Russian diplomat and his family. I can't help but think that my grandmother, my proud grandmother, would view the Russians as interlopers." Anna smiles. "She would be close by then. It's a good choice. It wasn't the Perez family for generations. In its day, it was one of the finest homes in Havana, a distinction your great-grandparents were proud of." "Do you think she would be happy there?" "Perhaps. Where else have you considered spreading her ashes?" "I'm not sure. Somewhere in the city, I guess. It seems like she belongs here." "Yes, she does. She loved Havana, even after it broke her heart." Anna gets up from the table, clearing our empty plates. "What was your grandfather like?" she asks from her position at the sink, her back to me. I rise, ignoring her protests as I help her wash the dishes. The need to stand on ceremony with Ana Rodriguez feels superfluous. Despite the fact that we just met, there is an ease to her manner, conveying the impression that a part of my grandmother, a chapter of her life, is here in her childhood best friend. I didn't know him well since he died when I was 10, I answer. They were happy, though, in love. She didn't date or anything after he died. Wasn't interested in it. She had us, her granddaughters, my father, and her causes. Besides, they were married for almost 40 years. I think it was hard for her to move on after spending so much of her life with him. I remember my grandmother's grief even now, standing beside her in the pew of the Church of the Little Flower as we laid my grandfather to rest, my hand clutched in hers as we mourned. 21 years later, I stood in the same pew, staring at the gleaming coffin where my grandmother lay, consoling myself in the fact that they were together again. Given my own parents' disastrous marriage, my grandparents were the ones I looked up to. Their story was filled with so much love and respect, giving me hope that one day I would find a good man, one I could trust, who would be both friend and partner, who would love me with as much devotion as I loved him. Everything Elisa told me about him made it sound like he was a lovely man. Ana smiles at me. Your grandmother wrote to me when she could throughout the years. She asked me to hold something for you. Let me get it from my room. She shuffles out of the kitchen, leaving me alone. I sit back down at the table, anticipation filling me. This is what I came for. To let a piece of my grandmother go and to perhaps find new pieces of her that I could clutch to my breast once I did. The two women from earlier re-enter the kitchen, neither one glancing in my direction, as though I've become part of the table and chairs. I stand and introduce myself. They both stare back at me. The elder woman speaks first.
I'm Caridad.
You met my son, Luis, earlier. So I was right. This is Ana's daughter-in-law. She possesses her son's height and his angular face, his graceful manner of moving. Yes, he was kind enough to meet me at the airport. We needed him here at the restaurant. It was busy today. She delivers the words with dart-like precision, the remainder unspoken. And we needed Ana's help today while you were busy chatting with her during the dinner service. My cheeks heat at the subtle rebuke as she passes by me without another glance. The younger woman meets my gaze with a flinty stare. I'm Cristina, Luis's wife. Disappointment shoots through me with a particularly lethal and effective stab. Silence fills the kitchen as we stare at each other. Here I feel the resentment I feared when I first planned my trip to Cuba. The unspoken censure that I am not a real Cuban, that I am a traitor to my people because my family left this country behind. The exiles in Miami and around the world hate Castro because he took their country from them. Because he took everything, really. But I see a different kind of anger here, simmering below the surface, contained in Luis's mother and his wife. For the most part, Cubans who left prospered, whereas those who stayed behind still appear to be struggling, despite the promises they received from the government. Cristina walks past me, leaving me alone in the kitchen that's stuck in a time warp. A product of the 50s modernized by makeshift repairs and a make-do attitude. How would my grandmother have fared in this version of Cuba? Somehow I can't imagine her making black beans and rice on an old stove. My grandmother was a study in contradictions depending on her relationship with you. The affectionate constant of my childhood, juxtaposed against the woman who ran Miami's exiled society with a jewel-covered hand. Her family had struggled after the revolution, of course. She told me stories about adjusting to an entirely new way of life in the United States, mourning the one she'd left behind in Cuba. Still, it took my great-grandfather years to build back all he lost from the revolution, the tangible things at least. But once he did, he bought one of the grandest estates in Palm Beach to show the world that not even communism could take down the Perez family. Did my grandmother go to bed? Luis asks as he walks over the threshold to the kitchen carrying a pile of dirty dishes. No, she went to her room for a moment. He sets the plates down on the tiny counter, his mouth in a firm line, his eyes tired. She needs to rest. Try telling her that, though. She lets us help to a point, but she still works harder than she should at her age. Luis washes the dishes, his back to me, and I walk over to the sink, picking up one of the rags and drying the ones he's already cleaned. He shoots me a curious look but doesn't say anything. My hands tremble as I wipe the cloth over a plate. The dishes are a hodgepodge. Some are clearly the remnants of expensive sets with elegant stamps on the back. Others are plain and cheap. Luis treats them all the same, his soapy fingers methodically scrubbing them with a worn cloth. His nails are neatly trimmed, his fingers lean, devoid of a ring. How long have they been married? The need to fill the silence tugs at me. You play beautifully. He doesn't respond. I heard you earlier on the saxophone. I add, nothing. Have you been playing long? The side of his mouth quirks up. While the women in the house, Anna excluded, of course, appear to view me through a filter of mistrust and disdain, he seems indulgently amused, as though I'm some bizarre creature taken out of her habitat and dropped in the middle of an environment where I clearly don't belong. Since I was a child, my father taught me. The father who died in Angola. I feel a pang of sadness for his mother who was left to raise a child in Cuba as a widow. Surely no easy feat. How old were you?
When he died?
Yes. 7. I swallow. I'm sorry. Luis rinses one of the plates, handing it to me, his fingers ghosting over mine for a moment before he turns to the next one, repeating the motions as though he's producing parts on an assembly line. I search for something else to contribute to the conversation, only to come up short, silence filling the kitchen save for the rush of water and the clunk of plates being set on the tiny countertop. Anna returns a moment later, a box in her hands. I finish drying the last dish and join her at the table while Luis excuses himself. The box is a dark wood with a small gold clasp, a little bigger than a shoebox. It's the sort of thing you'd expect to reside in a gentleman's study, holding cigars or cash, or jewels with mysterious provenances.
It was your great-grandfather's,
she smiles, handing it to me.
Elisa borrowed it.
My great-grandfather Emilio Perez, sugar baron, Batista supporter. He died before I was born, but I've seen old family photos of him. He was handsome, tall, and distinguished. The stories I've heard from my grandmother and great-aunts give the impression of a man more concerned with business than family, but a man they loved just the same. When families left Cuba, they didn't know how long they would be gone, Anna explains. Most thought Fidel's regime would be temporary. They weren't able to take items out of the country, but they also weren't comfortable leaving them in their homes for fear the government would seize them or others would steal them. So they buried them in their backyards and hid them in the walls of their homes for when they returned. My heart pounds. Your great-grandfather buried a large box of items in the backyard. She hesitates. Beatriz has it now. This is the first I've heard of Beatriz having some secret box of family possessions. How did Beatriz end up with it?
That's Beatriz's story to tell. Let's just say your great-aunt has led an interesting life, more so than you probably realized.
Considering the myth-like quality surrounding Beatriz, I'm not entirely shocked. The contents of this box, though, were your grandmother's. We buried the box together under a banana tree the night before she left Cuba. When the Russians moved into your family's home, I snuck back over there and dug it up before they could find it. I gape at her. She chuckles. Beatriz isn't the only one willing to take risks. Her hands stroke the wood.
It was the right thing to do.
Elisa wouldn't have wanted it to fall into someone else's hands, especially the people who took her home. I told her years later that I had the box, and she asked me to keep it for her, to keep it for you. She slides the box toward me.
I don't know what's in it. She never told me, and I never looked.
Go through it. If you have questions, find me. Anna reaches out, her hand covering mine. She loved you very much. Adored your father. Your family was her entire world. Her letters were filled with stories of all of you, so much so that I feel as though you're part of my family, too. She was trying to make the best of a difficult situation. You can't understand what those times were like, how our world was shattered in the span of a few months. Whatever you find, don't judge her too harshly. Later, I sit on the edge of the bed in the guest room, staring at the wooden box, running my fingers over the edges. My grandmother was 19 when she left Gula, and I try to imagine her as a young girl, caught in the midst of such political turmoil. If I had a box, not much larger than a shoebox, in which to place my most important possessions for safekeeping, what would I choose to guard? What did she save? The hinges creak as I open the box. Yellowed pages stare back at me, covered in ink, tied together with a red silk ribbon. Letters by the look of them. I set them aside. Next is a ring. My heart pounds. The center stone is a diamond, set in an Art Deco style, smaller diamonds cut in emerald and round shapes surrounding it. The ring itself isn't large, but it's elegant and clearly antique. The craftsmanship superb. We never grew up with family jewelry whose origins extended past my grandmother's time. Everything remained in Gula after they left, and eventually our valuables disappeared. In some ways, it's as though the Perez family was invented in 1959, so this piece of family history is everything. I slide the ring over my finger, delighted it fits. There are other items in the box. Concert programs, a white silk rose, the petals still soft, a faded map, a matchbook from a Chinese restaurant in Havana. Treasures that clearly possess more sentimental value than monetary. I go for the letters first, starting with the top one, expecting to be greeted by my grandmother's familiar, loopy handwriting. Instead, it's slanted, all hard lines and black ink. Masculine. I begin to read.
Chapter 6. Elisa. I barely recognize myself anymore. Last night I snuck out to a party with my sisters. Today I'm walking along the Malecón, on my way to meet a man whose last name I do not know, whose family I do not know, whom my family would likely never accept. We are the source of my mother's greatest pride, and also the instrument of all her ambitions. That Isabel at 23 is not yet married is a travesty my mother is unable to reconcile. Compounded by the sheer volume of marriage proposals received and summarily rejected by Beatrice, who at 21 should already be presiding over a home of her own, a child tucked away in a nanny's safekeeping. My unmarried state is hardly a priority with two older sisters, but it is no small thing either. Love is for the poor. In our world, you marry for status, for wealth, for family. And yet, here I am. The Malecón is one of my favorite parts of the city, 5 miles of seawall that showcase Havana at her most beautiful, especially during the moments when the sun sets, the sky exploding into a series of golds, pinks, and blues, like the colors that adorn the heavy paintings that hang on our walls. I pass a fruit vendor selling pineapples, mangoes, and bananas. He offers me a toothy grin before returning to his customers. I've chosen another white dress to wear to see Pablo, one of my favorites, another purchase from El Encanto. It was harder than I anticipated to sneak out of the house today. Maria wanted to come with me, and Magda kept glancing at me suspiciously, as though she could tell something had changed. This is to be a one-time indulgence. I will see him, and I will let myself have this hour or so to enjoy, and then I will return to Miramar and the dinner party my mother has planned for a judge, one of my father's cronies, whose son she hopes to foist onto Isabel. I will see Pablo, and then I will forget him, save for the very late hours of the night when I am alone and cannot sleep, or when I walk along the promenade, the waves licking at my skin. When I arrive at the point where we agreed to meet, Pablo is standing at the edge of the seawall, looking out over the water. It's surprising that I can hardly recognize him merely by the slope of his back, the dark hair, the manner in which he carries himself. But I can. My pulse quickens. I duck my head from prying eyes as my strides lengthen. It's risky being seen in public with him, in the daylight. But in this, too, I can't refuse. Pablo turns as I walk toward him.